an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest on today's show is Michael San Juan, an animal control officer with Hillsborough County. Having worked as an animal control officer for several years, Sergeant San Juan now serves in a supervisorial capacity, assisting fellow animal control officers as needed with certain cases. He also holds additional responsibilities as an animal abuse investigator. On a day-to-day basis, the Animal Control Division is responsible for enforcing local and state laws that protect pets and people. In a notable coincidence, given our own interest in spotlighting an animal control officer on Talking Animals, the Hillsborough County Media Relations Department recently produced a half-hour piece, Animal Control Unleashed, which is posted on YouTube. In my conversation with Sergeant San Juan, I aim to explore what animal control officers do, what they don't do, some misconceptions about the job, and more. That conversation is right around the corner when I welcome Sergeant San Juan here in just a moment on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later on today's program, I'll talk with Karen Schuneman, an award-winning nature and wildlife photographer whose work has appeared in the London Natural History Museum and Audubon Magazine. She'll be teaching a bird and wildlife photography class on February 15th at the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts in Tampa. More on this when I speak with Karen Schuneman later in today's program. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation with Michael San Juan about the realm of being an animal control officer, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Michael San Juan to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us in studio, no less, here on Talking Animals. That's always great to have folks, you know, you can see eye to eye and talk to them and have more direct conversations, so that's really greatly appreciated. So my assumption is that an animal control officer has a soft spot for animals, but let's back up your story sort of way before that in a way. How did you feel about animals when you were a kid?
I was that typical kid that would go out, find animals, and I was the one that was bringing them home. And so we grew up with a house full of animals because I would go out and go find them, bring them home. So I always had a passion for animals, helping them out. Between wildlife, you know, domestic animals. If it had legs and was walking, I was trying to help it out.
Yeah, where did you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey, which is where I started my career off up there. I've been doing this now for 22 years. So I got started up there and moved down here to Florida about 9 years ago.
I gotcha. And so did the family always have animals of their own, much less the ones you went and kind of helped rescue and on the street corner or down the road or whatever?
Yep. Yeah. We, between dogs and cats, we always had something in the house. And even the ones that were not the friendliest, I was always the one that never had an issue with them, never showed the fear of them. So I always knew that my career was going to end up being working with animals.
Well, even back then, even when you were just a kid, sort of helping them out and being that neighborhood kid,
yep,
you just thought, I'm going in the animal direction.
Absolutely. And well, it may have drove my parents a little bit nuts as a kid, but
Michael, you know, brought another animal home.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. You know, and then, you know, as I got older, those animals stayed with them as I moved out. But,
right.
You know,
but so then they were really mad. Yeah. So back there in New Jersey, was there any kind of discernible attitude, not necessarily in their family directly, maybe there too, but more broadly about animals? I mean, certain areas geographically and otherwise have kind of sort of almost like cultural feelings about animals, or hunting and fishing is one thing. Other places they frown on it. People go to circuses or do other things that animals use as entertainment, and other people sort of don't appreciate that. So was there any kind of discernible culture kind of in and around where you lived in that regard?
Absolutely. And same thing that you can run into down here. You know, different cultures treat, you know, animals differently. Some of them, they are just strictly an outside animal. They will never come in the house. You've got a lot of the hunt and breed dogs where they're not pets. You know, they're there to help them with the hunting. You have to understand, you know, those situations – Up north, with the cold weather, I would have to have those talks with them of you got to bring them inside. It's not the time to leave these animals outside. But you have to understand where these people are coming from. If this is a pet, if it's a working animal, sometimes it would be working animals on farms. And each situation, comes with its own set of problems that you have to deal with. And you have to understand it when you're talking to these people.
And we might be getting ahead of ourselves here, but then do you sort of, as an animal control officer, adapt your approach to that person based on what you understand that family's culture to be in terms of regarding their regard for animals?
Absolutely. You have to. You've got to understand the communities that you're in, where you're at, the culture that these people are coming from, so that way you understand how to approach them, what the best options are you can give them, the best resources you can offer them. So it definitely changes from neighborhood to neighborhood.
Yeah. And when you were growing up, did you or anyone in your family or anyone down the street have any kind of experience with an animal control officer of any kind?
Not that I could think of. I mean, at least nothing on the negative side. I mean, I know that they have come out and picked up stuff that I would bring home, but nothing on the negative side whatsoever.
Yeah. That's interesting. I wondered if there'd been that would be part of your history at all, just having kind of seen that in action, if that kind of helped influence your own path. But it sounds like that wasn't really the case. So this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Michael San Juan, a veteran animal control officer with Hillsborough County. Plan to discuss with Sergeant St. Juan what animal control officers do, what they don't do, some misconceptions about the job, and any kind of questions that you might have or comments by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So tell me about the situation or that pivotal moment considered, given your childhood of bringing home animals and tending to them, when you decided to say, hey, maybe I should become an animal control officer. Was there a light bulb moment of some kind?
Absolutely was. So when I was up north, I was doing a lot of wildlife work. So I was doing a lot of wildlife trapping. I was working with a lot of rehabilitators. So I was learning a lot about how to rehabilitate these animals. And because I was dealing with so much stuff with the wildlife, I wanted to make sure I was doing everything the correct legal way. So I went ahead and got certified as an animal control officer because I figured that was my best option to know what the laws were.
Sure.
Make sure that I was doing it correctly. So that's how I ended up getting started into it. And then from there, it just snowballed. People found out that I got certified. Different townships would reach out to me. Hey, would you be interested in being our animal control officer? I mean, it started off from one township to another, ended up with...
So you got recruited in a sense, like, hey,
absolutely.
Michael, come be our animal control officer.
Yeah, some people
That's
just...
probably a rare story, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and then it even got into military bases in New Jersey where I would do Fort Dix, I would do McGuire. Just my reputation got out there, but I had a passion. I did not mind coming out and working. I did what was right by the animals because that's the key thing. Everything you're doing has got to be what's in the best interest of that animal.
And even though you were already doing certain stuff with the wildlife trapping, et cetera, did you have any misgivings about becoming an animal control officer when people said, hey, come help us here, come help us there?
I didn't hesitate for a second.
I thought this is right for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I went... Two to three months straight without a day off, because that's just where my passion was. I wanted to put my heart and soul into it, which is what I did. Got better at it as the time went. Had some great mentors up there. Came down here, got some even some better mentors down here as well. And it's an industry where you're always learning. The approach changes constantly throughout the years. We learn
because of laws or because of evolving philosophy or what?
More philosophy than anything else.
Yeah.
Because we learn different techniques of how to safely handle the animals. The goal is to keep their stress levels low.
Yeah.
So you learn different techniques and tricks of being able to catch them safely, load them up safely. And key thing is keeping them safe, keeping the public safe as well. and you learn all these different things, you know, over the years. And that's what I do now is I teach our younger officers a lot of these tricks that we learn, ways to keep themselves safe, you know, be able to contain these animals. And the main thing is just make sure that everybody's safe, public and the animals at the same time.
Right. Well, it sounds like those mentors were pivotal for you. It sounds like you're now a mentor for them. What were some of the key things looking back that those early mentors kind of helped steer you in a direction or gave you some guidance that later turned out to be kind of crucial?
I mean, one in particular, especially up in New Jersey, you know, she was just an absolute asset with everything I was doing. You know, any questions, even with animal handling, she would show me, you know, different techniques. You know, when it came to, you know, bite dogs, you know, different ways of handling them, you know, to keep myself safe. You know, control poles are a big thing in our industry that, you know, get a bad reputation. She showed me a lot of great techniques of using that pole to be safer. And I've just taken what I've learned from them and just grew it, you know, so that way I could take that same knowledge, you know, and bring it along to the next generation.
Are people concerned when they see you with a control pole?
Absolutely.
Like what's going to happen?
There's a bad misconception, but it is an extremely safe tool to use. It's safe for the dogs. It's safe for us. It looks, you know, it's that perception. You know, it might look bad, but realistically, it's keeping them safe. You know, it does not hurt them. And same thing as a leash. It just, you know, what I call it, is it's a stiff leash. So, you know, it keeps a little bit of distance between you and the dog, but When you look at it, it can look like when, like, the dog is struggling with it, but the dog is completely safe the entire time.
And for people who are listening, it may not have seen one. Can you just kind of, I think people already kind of painted a little bit of a picture, but can you kind of describe what one of those poles looks like and how it works specifically?
So how the control poles work is it's got a loop at the end of it, and it's a solid pole. So that way, you know, you put the loop around the neck just like you would with any leash. And you don't tighten it down all the way. You just tighten it down loosely. So that way you've got some sort of control over them. So you're not choking them. You know, you're trying to get it high up on the neck. So that way you're not going to choke them out. And it's a way for you to keep control of the animal. It can't get somebody else. It can't bite somebody. It can't hurt itself. And it's a very safe, easy way to do it. As long as you're not tightening it down too much, you're never going to end up hurting a dog with that.
So it's essentially the same effect really to the animal, presumably, as a leash, basically.
Yes,
right?
It's the exact same thing.
If it's done
thing.
Right, it shouldn't feel any different than that.
Yep,
right?
Exactly. And as long as you're going slow, you know, the key thing is we don't want to scare them. You know, we want to keep everybody calm, safe. You know, and if you're using that properly, you're never going to hurt them. You know, it's what you're doing is you're impounding them in a way where it's safer for them. You know, they can't, you know, lunge out and bite somebody because they're scared. They're not going to bite you. They're not going to be able to get away from you. Key thing is safety. So, and that's a nice, safe way of doing it. Now, granted, if we can just put a leash on a dog, we're going to try that every time. You know, we've got different steps that we go through. If it's an extremely friendly dog, we're just going to slip a leash on it. If the dog kind of doesn't want to get too close to us, we might use that pole. Just depending on what's going on, we make sure we've got plenty of tools in our toolkit to be able to catch any of these animals.
And as I guess you're drawing on your experience over all these years to sort of determine which of those approaches you'll need to sort of deal with this particular animal that's standing in front of you or sitting in.
Absolutely, and that's something that we do a lot of as well. It's animal behavior. You need to be able to read a dog, and that's something that we go out to the public with a lot as well, trying to teach them how to read an animal's behavior, understanding when they're in a dangerous situation, when they need to back out of that situation, how to know when a dog's, you know, attitude is changing to more of an aggressive attitude. So it's something that I've learned over the years, and now we take that same knowledge and we provide trainings. You know, we provide trainings to postal carriers. We go to the schools and we talk to the children about dog bite prevention, how to avoid themselves from getting bit by dogs.
Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Michael San Juan, a veteran animal control officer of the Hillsborough County. And one of our emailers is asking, is he with FWC or PRC here? And really, if I understand things, as a a fairly recent development. It's kind of neither. I mean, at one point it was PRC, right?
Yeah, at one point when we were under PRC, now we are under Hillsborough County Code Enforcement.
I should say PRC stands for Pet Resource Center. I didn't mean to talk too jargony there.
So right now we are under Code Enforcement because we are an enforcement agency. So while we work hand-in-hand with the Pet Resource Center, we work hand-in-hand with FWC as well. There are certain animals that don't fall under our jurisdiction. So when we get into those situations, we do have FWC that comes out, and we work hand-in-hand with the Pet Resource Center with everything that we bring in.
So you used to be kind of more directly under the Pet Resource Center's umbrella, but that has shifted with kind of figuring out about compliance and code enforcement.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, I got you. Again, if you have any other questions for Michael, you can call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So what are the job requirements to become an animal control officer?
So the state requires a 40-hour course. Our department in particular, we also have a four-month training program that they go through as well. So we have a FTO program, which stands for a Field Training Officer Program. This is a program that we've created with law enforcement. It's the same program that law enforcement uses to train their new officers. It's the same exact program that we use with ours. So they come on board with us. They get 4 months of in the field training with our officers. They take a 40-hour course through the state as well. Then there's some other certifications that they get throughout that training as well. And after 4 months, then they're able to get out there and start handling these animals and running these calls.
And before they undergo that training or that education, are there certain attributes that a given applicant might have or not have that makes them either seem like a good candidate or maybe less of a good candidate?
Not necessarily. And the main thing is just, you can tell the people that have got the passion for the animals. And that's what we're always looking for, somebody that wants to be able to help them out. The main goal that we're always looking for is providing the animals as well as the people that the help them that they need. And you can see that in people, right off the bat. Most people are not applying for this type of a job unless they already have that passion in them.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's almost self-selecting, I guess, in that regard. Sort of.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one thing that I always say, too, is, it's a very interesting job because it's not just a job. When you get into it turns into your career really quickly. You realize that this is something I want to do for the rest of my life. It's very rewarding at the end of the day when you get to go home and say, I saved that dog. That dog was in a horrible situation. We got it out of it. Or this was a stray dog that was out there living on the streets, injured, sick, and I was able to save it. And when you can go home saying that I saved a life today, it's a rewarding career. It's something that you don't ever want to stop doing.
Yeah, well, this brings me to a question I was going to ask, because I think you already answered one of the questions, because I was going to ask. You said collectively between New Jersey and here, it's 22 years, you say?
Yep, 2004 is when I started.
Yeah. What are your, let's say, two or three favorite aspects? One, I think you just kind of cited, of the job. What do you love best about it day to day over all these years?
I mean, it sounds kind of silly, but what big thing I really enjoy doing is, especially with our younger people, between 22 years of doing this, I've made mistakes. And I love telling people about mistakes that I've made, so that way they learn from them.
Let's hear about a mistake you made then.
I mean, most of the time it's been getting bit. I've been bit many times over the years. They've all been minor bites because at the very last second I realized, oh, he's getting ready to bite me. I've been able to get back. But just trying to teach them of, every bite, if you look at it, you miss something, which goes back to the reading a dog's behavior, understanding that, and just always, seen awareness, always understanding where you're at, where are the animals at. Sometimes when we're out there trying to catch an animal, there's also people around. You got to understand that stuff as well. But just any mistakes, any bigger cases that I've worked, going over that stuff, report writing is a big thing. Trying to explain to the younger generation coming up, how reports have to be written, because we go to court with a lot of this stuff. It's just not, county court. We go to state court. We go to criminal court. We're on jury trials, with some of these criminal cases that we get involved in. So teaching them the mistakes in my report writing that I've made in the past, that way they don't do that same type of stuff. I always like to use myself as an example. I'm not a perfect person. I've made mistakes. And I've learned from those mistakes. So I'm going to try and help you from making that first initial mistake by telling you everything bad what I've ever done.
And how does that work? Because just hearing you talk and knowing a little bit about you before we got into the interview and seeing the videotape, the Unleashed Animal Control Unleashed, I would guess a lot of your colleagues, especially if they're younger, but just generally would want to like spend time with you and say, I'd like to learn more, I'd like to ride within that day, or like to whatever that I could do to be around Michael Moore. So how does that get determined, like who's going to spend time with you or be mentored by you in a given week or month or year or whatever?
So what happens is we've got six different supervisors within our department, and each supervisor's got a team that works under them. Each of them, you know, have got people that they get to mentor. I've been lucky. I've had a very younger team, which I've been able to enjoy because I'm watching their progress grow. That they, you know, started off as shy people, you know, a little bit timid, you know, with some dogs, and watching them now just going in there and doing exactly what needs to be done. They know my mentality of try to work with people. You know, that's the main goal for us, is, you know, work with the citizens, educate them, you know, try to make them be a better pet owner, give them the tools that they need. And they know that's what I'm always looking for. The goal is always to make everybody a better pet owner. We can't make them be the pet owner that we want to be, but we need to make sure that they're being the pet owner that the law requires them to be.
So you're obviously a key supervisor in the department. So how long do these stints with those people, like, I'm sure they probably have to go out of the nest, as it were, at a certain point. Like, how long are their stints with you before they're kind of turned loose, where they've gotten some extra training and mentoring from Michael?
So usually after they go through their 4 months of training with us, they will get released out there, but then we guide them. You know, and sometimes it takes up to a year of them being out there to really, get their feet under them, understand all the different aspects. And any of our supervisors are always available for our officers. And, you know, what people don't realize is, you know, we're here 24/7 every day of the year, holidays, nights, it doesn't matter. Our crew is out there running calls. We're out there assisting, you know, with emergencies all throughout the night. So all of our officers, you know, we're always learning, supervisors included. You know, the laws change constantly, so we have to stay up to date with all that stuff. And as we're learning it, we're passing that knowledge onto the officers out there.
And is there further kind of more formalized training, like conferences or seminars or things that people go to as well? Or?
Yeah, we do have a yearly conference that's actually coming up, I think, another month or two. So we do that every year. And then we also have in-house trainings that we do, and different parts of the department will have different trainings coming in. So I know not too long ago we had a representative from the state attorney's office came in to help us with, because when we do write our own search warrants, which is not something that's common throughout the state, but we do. There's a lot of things that we do that a lot of other jurisdictions in the state of Florida don't do, and one of those is write our own search warrants, on these criminal cases. So we've had people come in, you know, can give us trainings on how to write them better. So each department, our investigators and our officers might get different types of trainings. But all throughout the year, we're offering them different trainings throughout the year.
Yeah. And when I earlier asked you, what are your two or three favorite parts about the job? I guess it's only fair to ask the flip side of that. What are your two or three least favorite aspects of the job?
It's tough. I mean, there's so many parts of the job that I love. I mean, sometimes, you know, you can't always get through to everybody. You know, sometimes people are just stuck in their ways, and, you know, the pets are you know, they're going to live outside. And just understanding that my mentality and my thought, you know, if it doesn't go exactly with what the law says, I can't force somebody to do something.
Sure.
All I can do is tell them this is legally what you have to do. And when they go right up to that line and they don't want to give an inch more than that, there's nothing that I can really do at that point. And you just have to learn to be able to accept it. We can't help everybody. We try. You know, some people don't want the help. You know, and no matter how many times you go out there and you're offered different types of assistance, you know, if they don't want it, you know, there's nothing you can do. You can't force somebody to accept that help.
Yeah, frustrating, but at a certain point, you can't go any further than all the efforts. And I'm pretty sure, just based on what we've talked about and seeing that video and some other stuff, that you try every possible technique and come from every angle to try to persuade the folks to do the right thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's, you offer them the resources, you offer them guidance on how to get themselves out of that situation. And when you see that effort is being put in, then you need to do the same. You know, if that person is doing what we're asking of them, and maybe it's not perfect yet, but you want to try and help them along. And when you see that progress, you need to reward that progress. You know, don't do something good for that person. If that means you get to give an animal back to that person because they did what you needed them to do, it's a great feeling at the end of the day.
Yeah, there's a classic example of that on that Unleashed video.
Yes, and that was a great story. And that the Unleashed show that we ended up doing, you know, that too was just, you know, a fluke. You know, that it worked out great, where they wanted to come out and see a little bit more of what we were doing, and they came out with us one day and were like, we want to do this more. Like, you guys are doing some really good stuff out here that people don't realize. And one of the cases on that show was working with an elderly person who had a lot of cats. She got overwhelmed. You know, I went down there, we removed a lot of cats, and I told her, I said, if you can get this cleaned up, you know, she had two main cats she really, really wanted back. She put in that effort. She did what needed to be done. You know, it was a complete transformation of her house, her health, her family. Everything went exactly what we would have wanted it to do, and we were able to bring those cats back.
She was so thrilled. Yeah, and you were thrilled too, which was cool. I mean, everybody was happy with the outcome there, which I thought that's exactly how it should be in a perfect world, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's always our goal. You know, our goal is to work with the citizens out there, especially the ones that need help. You know, the ones that need help and actually will ask for it, that's what we're here for. We want to be able to help out these people.
Yeah. Well, that kind of brings me to another question. We're certainly a long way from the days of the so-called dog catcher and everything that kind of was thought about in that title or in that era. These days, how do you think animal control officers are perceived?
Much better than they were. The old stereotypical dog catcher is definitely a thing of yesteryear. We've been able to, you know, turn the public opinion on it, and that's what we're continuing to try to do, because people don't realize we're not just out there catching things. That's not our goal, is to just go out there and start taking animals away from people. You know, for people to see all the other little things that we do, people don't realize all the outreach work that we do and all the educational stuff that we do. And that's why the Unleashed show is also helping out with that, showing some of the different outreach work that we do.
Yeah.
You can't do this job without the outreach. The outreach is how you educate the public. You know, you can't expect somebody to do the right thing if they don't always know what the law says that they have to do. So you need to educate them. You need to provide them with the resources sometimes as well. And that's what we're out here doing.
And sometimes it's just intervention in a situation where all of a sudden there's too many cats and they're not bad people. They're not really doing anything, you know, cruel or really neglectful. It's just they got away from them. And you kind of come in and say, well, if you do this, this, and this, you can still have some of your cats, not all the cats that I'm seeing today. But, you know, so that there's a little objective and reward there that comes along. And Everybody's happy.
You give them a goal to shoot towards, and they're doing their part. You got to do your part to work with these people.
Yeah. So one of our emailers writes in saying, one thing I was curious about is what is happening to the pets of people who are being deported under the Trump immigration situation? Are they primarily being rehoused with family members or going more to shelters?
So we have actually been involved in several of these cases where we've gotten called out that people left their animals behind. The key thing with that is we also work with a lot of local rescues as well. So when they get word of these things, they'll reach out to us. Hey, you know, this is what we were advised. We went out there. We saw some loose dogs, and we will go out there if we know of a family member that's willing to take on the animal. That's our main goal. So that way they stay with family. If not, then unfortunately they do end up getting brought into the shelter. They'll get spayed, neutered, vaccinated, microchipped, and then go up for adoption from there.
Okay, cool. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Michael San Juan, animal control officer with Hillsborough County. We're discussing his background, a little bit what animal control officers do compared to what they did back in the day and what they don't do, and ways that they try to really help people. So we welcome your questions or comments by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So I'm just going to try kind of a, just a scattershot list of questions, maybe. So cold weather has certainly dominated the news lately, right, today in particular. But what should someone do if they see a dog in a hot car on a normal hot Tampa day where it's sweltering and no one seems to be around? What can they do and what are they legally entitled to do?
So it's a tricky thing. So with the dogs in the car, we get these calls all throughout the year. First thing, if you see that, you know, go into the store, you know, go into wherever that car is parked out, get that plate number and ask them to make an announcement. What else you want to do is contact us, contact law enforcement. Sometimes law enforcement, if you call them up, they can get out there a little bit quicker than us to at least hold the scene until we get out there. When we come out there, we're going to make an assessment. You know, is that dog in any sort of distress? And if so, we're going to make entry into that vehicle one way or another, because we're not going to let a dog, you know, die inside of a vehicle like that. It's a horrific thing to happen. And we're not going to allow that to go on. So if we need to go in there, we're going to go in there.
What if I take matters into my own hand and bash the window open?
The law says you have every legal right to do that, as long as that animal's in distress. And you just need to be able to show that, you know, I felt that animal's going to die in that car. And, you know, there are protections, you know, when it comes to stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not too drastic an action to take. If let's say you've been in the parking lot for a while, no one's around that car or that dog, and you're really worried about that dog making it. So you'd be within your bounds then to take a rock or whatever you needed to bust the window.
Technically, yes. Now, the downside with that is we lose evidence at that point. So, you know, everything when it comes to stuff like that, especially if that animal is in distress, we have potential criminal charges that we could file. But if somebody intervenes before we get there, any of that evidence, the temperatures, you know, temperature of the dog, the temperature of the inside of the vehicle, photos showing, you know, if the windows are up or down, car being off, a lot of the evidence is going to be gone, and then a criminal case at that point is going to end up getting hampered. So if it's safe enough to wait until we get on scene, that's always the best option. But if something's in distress, you know, you do whatever you need to do to make sure that animal's not.
Yeah, and know that it's at some cost. So if you do take the matters in your hand to that extent, that, I mean, you might be helping the dog, but it might be compromising kind of what could happen subsequently.
Yes, you know, as far as a legal case is concerned.
Yeah. One of our emailers writes, if somebody calls or fills out a form complaining about a resident that has many cats outside that are multiplying and or sick or injured, can they fine them? Or can they take them, or what can happen?
So when it comes, this is a very common thing that we get asked, and it comes into two different portions. One, we have what's called a TMVR program. So that's where we will get stray cats, we'll alter them, they'll get spay-neutered, they'll get what's called ear-notched. So that way we know at that point when we come back out that they've already been altered. Those cats are allowed to free roam. They can go any place that they want to. That is a policy that we've had set up in the county for many years now. Now, if a cat has not gone through that program and you are feeding them, you're providing them with food, water, housing, and that animal is now going off your property and going onto other people's property, yes, you can absolutely be issued citations for that for the animal being at large. But there are certain things we need. Like, we would need to have photos of the animal. We need to make sure that it's definitely not an ear-notched cat. But if it's one that's in that program, they're legally allowed to go any place that they want to. But if somebody's having a problem with a lot of outdoor cats and they're reproducing, that's telling me that they're not spay or neutered, absolutely, that would be something that they would want to contact our department about.
And that question in some ways kind of dovetails with one that I was going to ask, which is, how do I go about reporting what I consider to be animal cruelty or neglect? And what are the risks of doing so? Like, how can someone who was worried about the cat down the street, or how, you know, what's going on at the house three doors down or whatever, how can they take action to try to help the animal or animals, plural, but also make sure their own safety is assured?
So this gets a little bit trickier, because there was a new law that was passed where you cannot report something anonymously. So you have to put your name to that complaint. Now, if it's a cruelty, neglect complaint, you can either call our department directly, you can go onto the county website and submit a request that way, but they are going to ask for your information. We'll reach out to you first. Hey, exactly what have you been seeing going on out there? What's your concerns? And then we'll go deal with the animal owner. While we don't give out your information directly to that person, in, but we do need your information on there in order to be all
just so it seems like a legitimate report being filed, kind of. Otherwise, if it's anonymous, you'd think, well, it could be anything. Disputes. Could be some sort of dispute taking the form of a complaint about the animals or whatever.
Absolutely. And neighbor disputes are something that we get roped into all the time.
Sure.
It is definitely not uncommon.
What are your risks in carrying out your various duties in situations like this and others that we haven't even addressed yet? Are you ever feel like unsafe when you're going to intervene at a house when there's been a report of cruelty or some other issue going on?
It's always, you know, something that's in the back of your mind. You know, you've got to think about the fact that we are dealing with animals as well as the people. So it's always that fear, you know, but you got to just kind of push it down as you're dealing with the animal. But, you know, the people can also get very heated. When we're out there for a bad situation, they don't want you to take their animals, and sometimes you have to. So the people get a little heated and a little elevated as well, and you just have to put on your therapist hat at that point and calm everybody down, relax everybody, let them know that we're not there to you know, do anything bad, but we might need to be removing something. So there's always a lot of dangers that are out there between getting bit and then just the people that are upset about you even being out there.
Gotcha. All right, I think we have a caller that wants to get involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Michael San Juan.
Yes, I have a question, and I want to thank you, Duncan, so much for having an animal control officer as a guest. This is like a really important topic to me. I don't live in Hillsborough County, but I live in one of the surrounding counties, and I'm sorry I did come in a little bit late, so if you've already addressed this issue, I'll try to listen to the replay. Is it illegal in the state of Florida, and I'm assuming, you know, all the counties therefore, to trap a cat, a free-roaming cat, and then take it somewhere else, abandon it, dump it, relocate it, whatever term you'd like to use?
So that's actually a pretty easy one. So if somebody is trapping a cat and taking it and relocating it out to a wooded area, out to a rural area, with no expectation of care, but it's absolutely abandonment of the animal. You know, there's state laws that could fall under. Most counties will also have ordinances banning that as well. But if they're leaving these animals out in a place where there's no expectation of care, then absolutely that is something that somebody can get in trouble with. Now, if they're trapping an animal and bringing it to a vet's office and leaving it there or bringing it to a shelter, there's the expectation of care. But if you're just leaving it at a random place, it's not spay or neutered, nobody's going to be there taking care of it. Yes, that's absolutely something that people could be charged with.
Okay, and then thank you very much, because that was my understanding. But I have gone round and round with both sheriff's deputies in my county who say, nope, they can trap a cat and do whatever they want with it, who are uninformed. And it's so frustrating to me. I wish we could get the word out about that. As well as people who think, well, if the cat comes onto my property, now I happen to live in a mobile home park, you know, a small one, but still, and people feel like if it comes in their yard, they have a trap sitting there, they baited it, they can take the cat and take it wherever they'd like to. And somebody was actually caught red-handed by a sheriff's deputy in my county with a trap cat in the back, did not own it. And the guy said he could do, the sheriff's deputy said he could do whatever. So if you're able to cite, or if you know, if I can contact you or you can contact me later, I would love to know the name of that law so I can cite it to folks who are in law enforcement. Follow-up question real quick. What are the penalties for doing it?
So it's going to change from location to location. So depending on what their ordinances or how they're written in different counties, it could be just a civil fine. If you were trying to have somebody charged on the criminal level, it most likely would just end up being a misdemeanor. So it would be fines and penalties, possibly some probation. But that would most likely be the extent of it. And a part of what they're telling you is somewhat accurate as well. If an animal is on your property, yes, you have every legal right to trap it if it's on your property. But when you do so, you are obligated to bring that animal to a shelter or to a vet's office only. You cannot relocate them someplace else. So, yes, if it is on their property, they can trap it, but they are obligated to only bring them to those locations only.
Okay. Right. Thanks so much for your call.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Michael, you obviously love your job, and you have for a number of years, and you loved it before you even started doing it because you loved it as a kid doing, you know, whatever you could to help animals. So, still, your job does involve encountering hoarding situations, cases of neglect and cruelty, and so on. So what measures do you take to sort of protect yourself from burnout or worse, being exposed to these kind of things periodically at least, and maybe more often than that over the course of any given period?
I mean, oddly enough, burnout is a big thing in this industry. And, sure. And one way I try to not let myself get into that situation is every call that we go out on, especially hoarding situations, I always like to spend the extra time with these people, try to find the root cause. And that's what always kept me going, to figure out why is this person collecting animals? Because that's usually what it is. It started off with the collection. They got overwhelmed. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to ask for help. And as you're digging into more of that stuff, it keeps you more engaged with the process. That way you don't get to that burnout part. And just doing your best to try to understand where people came from, how they got into that situation. Because if you look at everything with a negative light, it's going to drain you. You got to find the positives every place where you can. Even if it's a small thing, you got to grab that and have that be your shining light for the day, because that's the only way you're going to be able to keep going through. We see a lot of horrible things out there. Animals are a thing that everybody's got some sort of passion for. And, you know, when you're seeing negative things about them, if you don't find those positives, you know, it's going to end up draining every little bit of good thing out of it.
Well, you still obviously love it, and you're obviously very good at it, and you're a virtue to the animals and a virtue to the people that live with and have animals and want to, you know, need help sometimes. And I think we're sort of unfortunately at the end of our time here, but I really enjoyed this. It's been Michael San Juan from Animal Control, Hillsborough County, and thanks again for joining us. Keep up the good work, and thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you very much for having me.
For sure. So in a moment, I'll speak with Karen Schuneman, an award-winning nature and wildlife photographer who will be teaching a bird and wildlife photography class at the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts in Tampa on February 15th. We'll hear more when Karen joins us in just a moment on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a fave who goes back to the beginning of the show, Brian Regan, with a piece called Animals in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WNF.
I lived in New York City for a while before I came out here. My apartment was small in New York. I had a goldfish, and I had to keep him in a shot glass. No, it's okay. A little pebble in there for scenery, so. He liked that. He was like, yeah. This is just like the ocean. I like to watch when you try to turn around here. Filtering system, I take a straw. It's like a jacuzzi room. Oh, yeah. I think people are unfair to their pets, you know? Like putting a pet bird in a cage, that's pretty nice, huh? Get in there, clank, shut up. I'll be making the decisions. I was wondering what a bird's thinking, standing in a cage. Hey, thank you. Hey, I've been blessed with the gift of flight. Appreciate the environment. I know how to fly, I'm standing on a stack. Hey, I've already read these newspapers. In fact, I've whited out some typos. I don't know what animals think. You know? You ever knock over an ant pile? Isn't it amazing that they all start rebuilding it that second? They're just, no, 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 no. They're all running around. You'd think, you know, there'd be just a minute, you know, where they'd all get upset. And you just knock it over. Oh, man! I don't believe it! Look at this! Even if most of them started working, there'd be a few hanging off to the side going, I ain't doing that again. Standing right there, just gonna knock it over again.
That was Brian Regan. Today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Animals, taken from his album simply entitled Live. Now it's time to speak with Karen Schuneman, an award-winning nature and wildlife photographer, about the bird and wildlife photography class she'll be teaching Feb 15 at the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts. Let's hear more now by welcoming Karen Schuneman to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. I appreciate it. So for those who may be unfamiliar, talk a little bit first about the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts.
Absolutely. The museum is located in Ybor City, and it has been around. It's going to be celebrating very shortly its 25th birthday.
Wow.
The museum is dedicated to photography, and that's all types of photography. Currently, there's a show by Dimpy Bolodia, who is a cell phone photographer, an iPhone, and her photography is extraordinary. And they've had shows, for example, by Carlton Ward, who did the movie Path of the Panther. So it's just diverse, and it's a little gem. It's an intimate place to go and see some exceptional photography.
Well, that sounds spectacular. And Carlton Ward, coincidentally, has been a guest on this show, and we were thrilled to speak with him when he was. So let's hear a little bit about you as both a photographer and a photography instructor.
Sure. I'm actually from California. I moved to Florida 5 years ago. And the reason, honestly, was we came through here in an RV and had never been in Florida before, and I was just mesmerized by the beauty of Florida, the wildlife, the birds, and we made a decision that this is where we wanted to move to after both my husband and I being from California our whole lives. So we moved here. I had been teaching photography in camera stores in California. I became a wildlife photographer about 15 years ago. Prior to that, I did like street photography, learned how to process film and the day of film, and I just found my niche in wildlife photography. So since then, some major things happened. I was honored by the London Natural History Museum. I was awarded a highly commended prize in the Wildlife Photographer of the Year contest, which includes the year that I was in it, over 46,000 images.
Wow.
Were in it. Yeah, incredible.
So I guess you know your way around the camera, I'm guessing.
I hope so. What the hell, I screw up, but that's why I teach classes, is that I share, you know, I think I've made all of the mistakes, so therefore I can teach you what those mistakes are, and hopefully the students will benefit from that.
Well, let's get into that then. It sounds like the perfect opening to do that. So the class is bird and wildlife photography. So what key elements of photographing birds and wildlife will be emphasized in the class?
Well, number one, photography, the actual word photography, means the study of light. So the first aspect that I talk about is just that. You know, the light is going to mold and shape your subject, and you can use that to make your images. The second thing that I talk about is you need to know about the animals, and wildlife photography certainly connects you to that from the very beginning. The first time you sit down to watch birds or wildlife, you know, you start that connection. But learning about their behaviors, learning what they eat, what time they get up in the morning, what their behavior, that's going to assist you in making better pictures. And my classes are about techniques and really composing the images versus you need to learn the camera stuff, because you do need to learn camera. You need to learn your cameras. I'm not teaching about a Canon versus a Nikon or a Sony. I'm teaching things that will help you no matter what camera you're using, including iPhones.
Okay, I was going to ask how many people in a class like this would typically be just iPhone type users versus people with actual cameras.
You know, it really varies. It just depends on that. I lead workshops to Africa, which you would think, okay, you're going to Africa, you're going to have the best camera available and so forth to go. The truth is I've had everything from, you know, really high-end DSLR cameras to iPhoneographers that have taken amazing pictures. And
It's
incredible. I mean, I say that the day that my iPhone has a 600-millimeter lens that produces quality images, there goes my gear, right? I'm going to be using an iPhone because they're light, they're easy to work with. But what I'm typically, you know, what I'm doing these days is I'm using a digital camera.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, you should come.
Yeah, well, no, it sounds like you're would be welcoming that, where some people might say, well, given the nature of the class and it's hooked to the museum, whatever, not that people would be snobby necessarily, but you just wouldn't think necessarily people would say, yeah, come on in with your iPhone without an actual camera.
Right, right. Well, sometimes when I actually look at images that I've taken with my iPhone, I sometimes go, wait a minute, I didn't notice that when I'm looking through my regular camera, and I will go back to my, you know, my big girl camera and go, oh, I didn't even notice that, but my iPhone kind of caught my eye, perhaps because it's a smaller image that you're looking at. I don't know, but sometimes I've caught things that I shouldn't have taken in a picture, and it pulls me back from it. So it can be a useful tool.
Interesting. So on a possibly related note, what are sort of the most common mistakes of those of us sort of amateur photographers, whether with a camera or with a phone, typically make in trying to capture images of birds or wildlife?
Good question. I think the first thing that comes to my mind is not paying attention to the background, because if you've got a really, really busy background, and this goes for not just wildlife, this will go if you're taking a portrait, you know, you don't want to have a pole going in the background, like through somebody's head, right? It would look rather strange. The same goes in wildlife, trying to compose an image where obviously you have nice light, but what's going on behind the subject? The first time I went to Africa, I was so excited about seeing the animals that all the stuff that I knew about photography kind of went out the door the first day. And that night when I started to look at my images, I'm going, oh my heck, what was I thinking? I've got all these crappy pictures. And it really, again, made me focus. And the background is critical, because if it's too busy, you've got all kinds of stuff going on, it pulls away from the subject. And it's something that ultimately you're probably not going to want to keep.
Okay, so there's a tip right there without even having to attend the class. So that's a freebie right there. So to actually take the class, I assume people go to the museum's website?
Correct.
So yes, that's FMOPA, I believe, right? .org, is that right?
Yes, it is, .org. Right.
Yeah.
And there's a tab on there on the main page that says classes, and they offer an array of classes. There's everything from cell phone photography to very cool. There are photographers that come in and talk about the history of photography, and they're exceptional. And there are, you know, again, just different types of advertising, all kinds of different photography. Obviously, my wildlife class is coming up on February 15th, and it's from 10 until noon. And it's also going to repeat itself on March 15th for those that are interested. And it's easy. Just go to the website and you can sign up for the class.
Well, that sounds great. Well, thanks for joining us on Talking Animals and filling us in on the class and some other tidbits about photography that we got as an added bonus. So thanks so much, Karen.
Thank you for having me, Duncan. All the best.
Same to you. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye. Coming up on WNF, it's the conversation that Rachel hosted by Mario Nunez and Joaquin Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Wall, holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C, hosting the Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m. And just great music continues after that here on 88.5 WNF. So, meanwhile, on this show, as the prize for Name That Animal, Tim will be offering something from the Talking Animals Vault to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. Because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Glad to tune in next week for another edition of the show here at 11 a.m. on WMNF. Also invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. Apple Podcasts and other podcasts are there too. Go to the links to sign up for our social media pages and more. That's all at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Stay tuned for the conversation coming up shortly here on 88.5 FM WNF Tampa. See you next Wednesday. Thanks.